So for this evening's talk, I wanted to discuss a little bit on some of the things that we've been talking about the last few days. And one of the topics, which is one of the perennial Buddhist family arguments, is about the Bodhisattva versus the Arahant. It's the heavyweight boxing match of Buddhism. It's like Muhammad Ali versus Joe Frazier or something like that. And of course the Theravadins put all their money on the Arahant, and the Mahayanas put all their money on the Bodhisattva, and we're all cheering our own team on to win the battle. Of course the ones cheering on the battle typically themselves aren't either Arahants or Bodhisattvas, and the Arahants and Bodhisattvas themselves are probably not all that concerned about the argument. So it's a slightly peculiar situation, as it's so commonly in Buddhism. But anyway, I'd just like to talk about that from just to sum up from a few different perspectives. And one perspective, of course, that I have a particular interest in is the historical and text critical study. And particularly that kind of study is useful and interesting because it reveals new ways of looking at the Dhamma, opens up new avenues for insight, investigation, which are sometimes different from the ones which we're conventionally taught. And those new ways of seeing things I find very interesting because they give more of a three-dimensional picture of Buddhism. And I feel that sometimes when we're presented with conventional Buddhist teachings, that, well, they are conventional. And to me, they're often flat, they're two-dimensional. They present a sort of a teaching or doctrine as if it's just there and unquestioned and has always been like that, whereas in fact the particular modes of presentation, things that are emphasized, ways things are talked about, these are very much a product of time and place and things which mean different things to different practitioners at different times. And so these are the kind of the richness that we try to discern through using text critical studies. And so if we, just to summarise very briefly what I think the outcome of the text critical study on this matter is, would be something like this. In the earliest phase of the texts, which I would suspect is the only phase that we could attribute to the Buddha himself, then we find the word bodhisattva used in the meaning of one who is intent on enlightenment, or one who is striving for enlightenment. And that is used by the Buddha to refer to himself after he had left the home and was in the period of 6 years practicing to realize enlightenment. And as I said, my suspicion is that that's quite likely the only way that the Buddha himself used the word bodhisattva. In a somewhat later period of the text, but still the canonical texts, we find the word bodhisattva used to refer to Siddhartha before he went forth, when he was, for example, a young baby and so on. And also we find it used in reference to Buddhas in past Buddhas, so Vipassi Bodhisattva, for example. And I think this is a development that happened sometime after the Buddha's passing away in the early period of the redaction of the text, say 100 or 200 years after the Buddha. In that period, by shifting that, then there's a slightly different nuance. It no longer becomes the one who's gone forth and is striving for enlightenment. But especially when we look at the narrative of the Siddhartha's birth, it becomes almost as if he's destined for enlightenment right from the time that he's born, which is quite a different kind of idea. In later texts, and in the late canonical period, we find that that this is made quite explicit, and that we begin to see the emergence of the familiar features of the developed bodhisattva ideal, and that is that in a time far, far, far in the past, many eons ago, a certain being was inspired to practice to become a Buddha. He made a resolution and announced that to a Buddha in that period, many eons ago, another Buddha, and the Buddha confirmed that he would in fact realize enlightenment as Siddhartha Gautama in the far future. And from that period he then embarked on a series of many, many thousands of lifetimes of being reborn in almost every realm of existence, and each time practicing and developing the what's known as the paramis, the qualities that need to be perfected for Buddhahood, which come in various lists. Most well known is the six paramis of the Mahayana texts, which is dana, is generosity; sila is ethics; kanti is patience; virya is, or perhaps acceptance is better than patience for kanti; virya, energy; samadhi, concentration; and panya is wisdom. That's the most common list in the Mahayana texts. In the Theravadin text has another list of 10 paramitas, which are slightly different. And so the being who's going to become the Bodhisattva sort of toils away lifetime after lifetime, each life perfecting or practicing one or more of these qualities. And many of these, of course, recorded in the Jataka tales, and of course many hundreds of these Jataka tales. And in some of them it's identified which, not actually often, but occasionally there's an identification that in such and such a birth he was developing the quality of wisdom or energy or whatever the quality may be. So for example, where Santara Jataka is said to be where the Buddha perfected the parami of generosity, whereas the Umagga Jataka is where he developed the quality of wisdom, and so on. And as a result of developing all those factors, then he was born in this lifetime virtually on the cusp of attaining Buddhahood already. It's said that even at the time when he made his first resolution to become a Buddha, all those countless eons ago, before he actually started developing the paramis, it's said that already in that life he could, if he wished, have become an arahant with all the psychic powers. So he's already that spiritually developed in that lifetime, and then so much more so when he comes to this life. And so this is a later developed idea of the Bodhisattva, and I won't go through all the various very many reasons why I don't think that ideal agrees with the picture as depicted in the early texts. And the Mahayana scriptures, of course, even go further and talk about many different kinds of bodhisattvas of different kinds of qualities. And the bodhisattva's principal quality is that they've renounced nibbana so that they can work for the liberation of all sentient beings. And so even though they, as it were, stand at the gateway of nibbana and could step through it at any time, but they choose to renounce that bliss for the sake of helping others. So that's like a rough history of the idea of the Bodhisattva in Buddhism up to the advent of the Mahayana. And one of the major developments that happened, of course, was that the Bodhisattva came to supplant or replace or supplement the ideal of the Arahant, which is found in the early Buddhist texts. And of course there's no question that in early Buddhism the only goal of spiritual practice is arahantship. That's unquestionable. There's no other way of reading the early texts. But gradually there came to be the Bodhisattva ideal came to replace it, and was regarded as in some ways even superior. And typically it said that the arahant's liberation is limited because they only become liberated through eliminating their own defilements, their own ignorance, and so on, and without concern and compassion for others. This kind of critique is made with varying degrees of sophistication in various texts. So it seems to me that this is this kind of development is telling all kinds of stories, which can be read in all kinds of different ways. One way that it can be read is that it suggests to me that the picture of an arahant as being selfish seems to me to be so removed from reality that it suggests to me that those people who are composing these doctrines had not only lost contact with living arahants, but had vanishingly little idea of what it might be to be an arahant. And that what they were referring to as arahants was not actual arahants, who were probably not getting involved in these arguments, but were probably sitting in caves or under trees in the jungle. But they were talking about a stereotype of a kind of monk who became used as a literary device, that they became identified with the arahants. We should note also that the idea that the bodhisattva is essentially involved, engaged in the world and helping people, is itself not uniformly taught by any means in the Mahayana sutras. Many Mahayana sutras say that a bodhisattva should reject company, they should not associate with people, they should resort to the forests and the secluded wilderness areas where no people will come, and if people do come, they should speak to them with words of dismissal and words of emptiness and words of seclusion. And you find these kinds of passages quite frequently in many of the Mahayana texts, especially the early ones. So it's not as simple, the situation is not as simple as one might imagine. So if you kind of step back a little bit from trying to interpret these things too literally and try to, meaning that the bodhisattvas are actually bodhisattvas and the arahants are actually arahants, and try to sort of consider a little bit how they are used and how their dynamic works within a Buddhist community. And, what we see is a usage which is also quite common today. Like if somebody, especially with the use of the bodhisattva, it's of course very common that if somebody is very helpful and very kind and so on, then they say, oh, they're a real bodhisattva. Yeah, it becomes a term for that's used in that way. So it seems to me that these have become like words which were used to depict or to present certain aspects of Buddhist practice, and that although historically the critique which places the bodhisattva as superior to an arahant can't be taken as being a literal or accurate representation of the actual Buddha's teachings, but nevertheless the critique has something to it, and I think it actually has something very important to say. I don't think we can just dismiss it because it's a later development. I think this is a serious mistake. The reality is that I know lots of monks who are just like the arahants, who are satirized and criticized in some of the scriptures. And yes, they are selfish, and yes, they're not very concerned with others. And yes, it seems that often the very notions and forms which are supposed to lead to letting go of the self and letting go of one's sort of self-interestedness actually lead to the opposite and lead to a great deal of conceit, to a sense of entitlement, that you should be treated in a certain way because you're a monk, you should be treated like this or like that. And I think this is a serious problem and a very, very real problem for those of us who've ordained in the tradition. I remember one story, for example, one senior monk told me a story that he was on Tudong, wandering around Thailand. And he showed up at some monastery as a fairly junior monk and came to the monastery and met a monk there and said he was coming in and, could you show me to a hut or something like that, or can I stay for a few days? And so the monk said no problems and brought him over to a kuti, and then the monk sort of grabbed a broom and swept out the kuti and so on.
and prepared it for him according to the duties as described in the vineyard. And when I was being told this story, I remember it quite vividly, and the monk who was telling me the story was then the punchline of the story was that he found out later that even though he himself was only a junior monk, the monk who had met him and was cleaning his kuti for him had 20 vasa, 20 reins. And so he was praising that monk's humility for being so kind as to clean his kuti for him when he was such a senior monk. Now I find that quite, you know, just stop and think about that for a minute. That it should be considered virtuous for a monk who's been around for a few years to actually do a simple act of kindness. That's considered like a special virtue, something that you wouldn't expect, something that was surprising or unusual enough to remember it many years later and to tell the story. Isn't that? The more I go on in my life as a monk, the more I find these things to be increasingly strange. Surely, how would that even matter? You know, that a simple act of kindness is done. Why should notions of superiority or seniority or anything even be vaguely relevant for it? And so these are the kinds of attitudes which we see satirized in suttas like the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, which we've spoken of in the last couple of days, where Sariputta refuses to sit because the seat isn't high enough for him, and so on and so forth. And obviously this is a character, it's not the real Sariputta. But there's plenty of monks who behave like this, in small ways and big ways. And so the reason I'm saying this story is not to criticize anybody or put anybody down, but just to raise it for awareness and to raise it into consciousness as something which is very, very important for us to understand as monastics. And I'm very aware of it because I've you know, experienced it myself. The same thing. I remember when I came back from Thailand after being ordained as a monk there for about 3 years, and I came back, and one of the first things that I did, or after I spent some time in Bodhinyana, I went to my mum's house and we had the Christmas lunch that year. And I could feel this kind of thing, because it was the first time, I think, that I'd had, you know, lunch in that way with lay people as a monk. And just everybody sitting around the table and everybody, you know, just acting like normal, you know. It wasn't a big deal to have a monk there. I mean, they're all very good. My mum would leap on top of my aunties and stop them from hugging me and things like that. And they all make sure that everything was offered properly and stuff. So it was all very proper, you know. But I could see this kind of resistance in myself that somehow, it was kind of wrong. I'm a monk and I should be, you know, there should be something special or something like that. I could really see that very clearly. And then sort of realize that actually that's just pride, that's just conceit. So that's something that really needs to be worked on. So living in Australia is very useful in that regard. If you ever have that kind of problem, then just jump on a train or a bus in Australia. Especially it's good at about 3:30 or 4 o'clock after school's just closed. And hang out with some of the school kids and get called names and stuff like that. And it's very good for your conceit. So these are these kinds of attitudes which I think are quite evident in the Sangha. And not everybody, of course, but that's the tendency. And obviously the reasons for it are fairly clear, because of the way that we get treated with so much respect and get revered. We get offered everything first and all of those kinds of things. And they little bit by little bit by little bit, they add up to a sense of entitlement and a sense of conceit in our hearts, which is, I think, very sad, because none of us have ordained in order to develop those bad qualities. We've all ordained and practicing to be able to let go of them. But they are actually reinforced by the form that we use, so we have to be very alert to them and to be letting go of them as much as possible. And so you'll notice that in this monastery, I try to avoid the trappings of of the senior monk trappings, the big spittoon and the high seat and all of those things. I'm doing it quite deliberately for myself and also for those who come afterwards, that we don't get into this, what I think is quite a serious mistake. And so this is the critique of the Arahant, and of course the critique of the Bodhisattva, would be that the Bodhisattva is basically trying to help others but hasn't learned to help themselves. And that you're going around trying to solve everybody else's problems. But actually you can only do a very small amount to solve others' problems. This is the basic thing, isn't it? You can do a hell of a lot to solve your own problems, yeah, to get rid of greed, hatred and delusion in your own heart. You can do it completely, you can do it perfectly. But you can't really get rid of greed, hatred and delusion in other people's hearts. I mean, you can help them a bit. So this would be the critique of the Bodhisattva's Bodhisattva ideal, is that while it sounds very good in theory, in practice you basically end up becoming distracted and getting involved in all kinds of fairly shallow activities, which may be good things and, you know, decent things to do, but which are not really leading to the goal, or are distracting from a deeper penetration to the goal, such deeper practices leading to the penetration of the goal, such as, of course, meditation. And I think we could all agree that there's some validity to that critique. And if we look at the Buddhist orders where they practice what they call engaged Buddhism, and do a lot of fantastic work to help others, and this is of course very prominent in especially the Taiwanese tradition, but also in other places as well. And you know, we've heard stories from many people within those traditions that, well, yes, they don't actually have time to meditate, and well, yes, you can be in those places for many years embodying that goal of helping and serving others, but at the end of the day you really don't feel like you've actually developed anything spiritually, and you certainly don't feel like you've gained the clarity and the depth of insight that you can gain through meditation. On the other hand, through doing meditation in a meditation retreat, there's no doubt that many people, and probably most people, will definitely experience a level of peace and clarity of mind which very clearly indicates that there's progress in the path. So this is the Arahant's critique of the Bodhisattva, I would guess, you know, from that point of view. And I think there's something to that. And so this is where we're at, and these are the kinds of things we have to negotiate. And one of issues is, or when, if we come back to what the Buddha himself taught and try to look and see, well, is there a solution to this problem, or rather why did the problem not occur in the suttas? Yeah? The Buddha, you know, doesn't set up this opposition between arahants and bodhisattvas and so on, and you know, the idea from a sutta point of view, the idea that an arahant is selfish and lacking compassion, is of course completely absurd. The arahants are constantly being said to be developed the Brahma Viharas, and constantly being depicted as acting in very compassionate ways. The shift towards the, if you like, selfish arahant ideal is perhaps has its precursor in Venerable Mahakasapa and his depiction in the canon. Although that's not, I mean, there are just as many suttas which praise Mahakasapa's compassion and kindness towards lay people, for example. But more specifically, the Bakula Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya very clearly marks the emergence of the selfish arahant ideal. It's a sutta which has no parallel in the Chinese Agamas, and which on the internal evidence was clearly redacted somewhat later than most of the rest of the Majjhima Nikaya, and in that text Bhakkhula is said to say things like, you know, all my life as a monk that I've never done any work to help anybody, even so much as putting a stitch in a robe for somebody else or something like this. Oh, sadhu, sadhu is a wonderful and marvelous quality. I've never taken on any students, and I've never done this, and I've never done that. And this is all praised and regarded as being the great qualities of Venerable Bhakkhula. And so this clearly is like this direction. And one of the earliest indications of this shift in emphasis is in one of the stories in the Ashokavadana, where King Ashoka is going with Venerable Upagupta and he's paying respects to the shrines of the great arahants. And at each shrine he makes an offering, and he goes to the shrine of Sariputta, and Upagupta tells him the story of Sariputta and who he was and what he did, and he makes a wonderful offering there, and then Moggallana, Mahakasapa, Ananda and all the rest. And when he comes to the shrine of Venerable Bhakkhula, Ananda tells him the story of Bhakkhula and the sutta, and he says, oh, well, you know, I'll give him a kahapana, you know, just one copper coin, as an offering to that shrine, because he was only interested in his own welfare and not the welfare of others. So there seems to be this kind of shift, this kind of emerging pattern, which demanded the response of the Bodhisattva ideal, but it's not found in the early texts. And actually what we find in the early suttas, that the whole argument just doesn't get any footing. For example, one of the lovely passages in the from the Upanishad Sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, Atatangwahi bhikkhave sampasamanena alameva apamadena sampadetum, paratangwahi bhikkhave sampasamanena alameva apamadena sampadetum, ubhayatangwahi bhikkhave sampasamanena alameva apamadena sampadetum. With having regard for one's own benefit, then just this is sufficient for striving. Having regard for the benefit of others, just this is sufficient for striving. Having regard for the benefit of both, just this is sufficient for striving. So this kind of analysis is very, very typical of the way that the suttas move. Yeah? You start with one's own benefit. Yeah? Start with the most straightforward and simple thing. This is what we do every day, is we act out of our own benefit. But if we really see what our own benefit is, it doesn't mean being selfish, accumulating possessions and all of these kinds of things. It means alameva appamadena sampadetum. It's enough to strive on with diligence, to practice. If we really knew what was for our own benefit, we would really strive for our own good. And this, interestingly enough, is mentioned quite explicitly in the only written text which is attributed to Ajahn Mun. And Ajahn, in the Thai forest tradition, of course, as is well known, Ajahn Mun at a certain time in his practice had a realization or recollection that he'd made a bodhisattva vow in his past life, and formally relinquished that vow so that he could attain arahantship in this life. And in the only written work attributed to him, the Kanda Vimutti Samagidhamma, he starts out by saying talking about a man who was intent on his own good, and then detailing the practice that he would do. So it's intent on one's own good, then that's enough for practice. And of course the paradox about that is that in the case of somebody like Ajahn Mun, who, you know, very much embodies the arahant ideal of someone striving for their own benefit, we can see how much that has in fact overflowed and benefited so many other people. And the benefits of Ajahn Mun and the establishment of the whole Thai forest tradition, right down to the present day and the existence of our temple here. And all of us here today, we're still flowing on. And we wouldn't be here, certainly not in the same way, if it wasn't for Ajahn Mun and for the practice of those who are practicing only to benefit themselves. So it's very interesting to see that, and to see that, you know, many, many people practicing bodhisattva ideals, but in fact, how many people do they benefit? Whereas those practicing the so-called selfish arahant ideals, in some cases, not necessarily every case, but in some cases, will benefit tremendous amounts of people. These things work in mysterious ways. And then the second one, the benefit, practicing for the benefit of others, then just this is enough for striving. So considering what good can come for others also is enough for practice. And so the text doesn't get into an argument, is it better to practice thinking of your own good, or is it better to practice thinking of somebody else's good? It doesn't matter. What matters is that you practice. That's the important thing. And in part, I think that this difference and the Arahant Bodhisattva ideal is really just a matter of, a part of it is really just a matter of character and personality. And some people are simply more suited to a way of practice that's more secluded and solitary. Others are much more suited to a life of service. And sometimes if you forced one person into one role or another, it just wouldn't work. And so that's why I think the Buddha, rather than making a problem out of this, he said, well, think of your own good. That's good enough to practice. Think about the good for others. That's good enough to practice. Because when we practice sincerely, look at how much benefit it does bring to others. Yeah? The inspiration it brings to others, the qualities of wisdom and compassion that we can develop, that we can use later for helping others. The overflow that comes from the development of good qualities is just, it can't be measured or calculated. It just keeps on flowing. You know, the strength that can come from this. And then finally, ubayatang va bhikkhave, or thinking of the benefit of both, or having regard for the benefit of both oneself and others. So the ubayata, of course, is the most interesting and the most profound. And as the suttas so often do, they go from what's more obvious to what's more subtle. They move from what's making more conventional distinctions to what transcends those distinctions. And so, of course, at the end of the day, this transcends the distinction between oneself and others. We're thinking of the benefit of both, we practice, because at the end of the day, both oneself and others are just sentient beings. We're just little lumps of five khandhas filled with suffering. That's all. Filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, and floundering around trying to get a way out of it. So we don't have to think about, it doesn't matter whether it's ourselves, it doesn't matter if it's others. Can we help to get rid of greed, hatred, and delusion? Can we help that in ourselves? Can we help that in others? It doesn't matter, as long as we're doing that. So this, I think it's very important that when we're developing our practice, that we have some awareness of these dynamics. They are very practical, very immediate dynamics. They're things which confront all of us in our practice. And they confront us every single day. Do I right now go and meditate, or do I right now go and help somebody, do some chores or some cleaning or some work? That's a choice we face constantly every day. So the answer, of course, is balance. So we need to find the right balance. Sometimes it's best to help, sometimes it's best to meditate. But what exactly is that balance? It's a dynamic thing and it's an individual thing. You can't solve the problem for everyone. But we need to keep on checking. I think if the problem comes, as so often, when we fall into the extremes, when we start to idealize just one side of these or the other. I think that can work for a few people. You know, there's a few people who can just become a silent sage and go off into a cave and meditate and never talk to anyone, and then that's terrific for them. And there's a few people who can just live a life of devotion and service. But for most of us, we're going to be trying to find a balance, and that balance will be shifting. It'll be different at different times in our lives, in our spiritual practice. It'll be different when the context and surrounding is different, and all of these things. But I think the most important thing to bear in mind is that whether you are intent on striving for your own good or for the good of others, just do it at the best you possibly can. Just love it. Just throw yourself at it. That's all. And then if you do that, that will never lead to any kind of bad result. If we're doing one thing and we're always longing to be doing the other, then we'll never be doing anything 100%. If we're sitting in meditation in our kuti and we're feeling perhaps a bit guilty because we know that you know somebody's out working this afternoon and we really felt that we should have offered to go and help them, and you feel a bit guilty about not going to help them, then you're not really being with your meditation. Yeah? On the other hand, if you're doing your job and you're kind of a bit resentful and you're thinking, you know, I did when I was an agarika, thinking to myself, I didn't come to the monastery to scrub pots. And then, of course, you're not getting the benefit of the service and the help that you're doing for others. So always to keep this balance. If we keep the balance and we love and throw ourselves into whatever we're doing with a passion, then we're always going to be okay, as long as what we're doing is good. And at the end of the day, try to transcend that. So this is that reflection that I use for myself, is that when I'm in my heart and when I'm meditating in private, then I'm doing that for the sake of others. And when I'm working and helping people, then I'm doing that for my own sake. So because I'm meditating in my seclusion and keeping solitude, then I'm trying to, and hopefully that will set an example and be an inspiration, and also will help to develop my mind in a good way that will be useful for others. So that's why being in seclusion is do it for the benefit of others. And then when you're working, serving, helping people, teaching, all of those things, then you do that thinking, oh, I'm going to overcome my own selfishness, I'm going to overcome my own ignorance. And talking to people then it helps to overcome your own ignorance, helping to overcome my own conceit, a sense of entitlement. So this is just a few reflections for this evening on these two ways of the Arahant and the Bodhisattva, practicing for oneself, practicing for others. So I offer this for your reflection, and I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
Bhagavato Sāvana Saṅgho Saṅghaṁ.